A broadband cooperative featuring all fiber optic Gigazone internet speeds up to 10 gig and local customer service. Learn more at paulbunyan.net. Mostly clear overnight with some patchy fog late, lows 49 to 52.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden. Coming up on As It Happens...
Justice delayed. The Ugandan rebel leader Joseph Kony is still at large, but the war crimes case against him at the International Criminal Court is going ahead. A man whose mother was 12 when she was abducted from her school and held captive by Kony's militia says it tore his country apart, and to see him tried in absentia is cold comfort.
And there are plenty of deep sea fish in the sea, and scientists have now discovered that at least one of them is cute. Unlike so many of its fascinating yet unsightly neighbors, the newly identified bumpy snailfish has been deemed pretty adorable.
It is, really. Those stories and more coming up for you on the Wednesday edition of As It Happens.
There is more ahead from As It Happens here in a few minutes on KAXC. Coming up in just a few moments, we're going to hear the set list, but first, let's sample our album of the week. Arrivals and Departures, Adventures of Captain Kurt by Kurt Harding. This is a sci-fi concept album that brings classic soul to a space opera. It's the fourth album from this Atlanta-based soul singer. The song we're going to hear this evening is called The Power.
Joy comes faster. Rain don't feel like it used to. The sunlight feels better. Well, just be your life and don't you give up now.
This is the setlist on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are looking at shows Thursday through Saturday, September 11th through the 13th, in Grand Rapids, Aiken, Coleraine, and Big Fork. First up, folk singer-songwriter Rachel Kilgore is coming to the Co-House in Grand Rapids Thursday at 7:30 p.m. The Duluth singer won the 2017 Careville New Folk Contest and most recently released the album My Father Loved Me in 2023, which explored her relationship with her late father. She is a 2025 McKnight Music Fellow. It is Rachel Kilgore this Thursday at the Co-House in Grand Rapids. On Friday, Jay Bell and the Lazy Susan Band are playing The Terrace in downtown Aiken at 7 p.m. An Americana and rock and roll band that features a horn section, B3 Hammond, and twangy guitars, they've released 6 albums since forming in 2001. Jay Bell and the Lazy Susan Band in Aiken Friday night. On Saturday, the Bugle Boys are playing at Smoke on the Water in Coleraine at 6 p.m. A stripped-down duo of vocalist and guitarist Clay Fulton and the drummer from his band, The Lost 40, the Bugle Boys play a stomping and rowdy brand of folk blues music. Saturday in Coleraine at Smoke on the Water. Finally, Sam Miltich and friends are playing at the Edge Center for the Arts in Big Fork Saturday at 7 p.m. The Militici new music from the Old Country Show will feature the jazz group's take on Balkan and other Eastern European folk music, a style Miltich explored on his 2019 album, Peasants with Torches. Sam Miltich and friends in Big Fork this Saturday. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund, and we'll post the latest edition every Wednesday at kaxc.org.
Hello, I'm Neil Kirksall.
Good evening, I'm Chris Howden. This is As It Happens. Tonight.
Empty court press. Ugandan rebel leader Joseph Kony is not at the International Criminal Court to hear evidence of his war crimes. Our guest was born into his militia and says there can be no justice until Kony is captured.
Hoping slow and unsteady wins the race. Hong Kong lawmakers reject limited rights for some same-sex couples. An advocate tells us he's disappointed, but still certain that progress will be made eventually.
Iced out, a youth minister in Rochester, New York, explains how her community confronted ICE agents when they tried to arrest roofers working on a house.
An assembly about what to assemble. Prime Minister Mark Carney spends his last days before heading back to Parliament talking about nation-building projects with his caucus and with Alberta Premier Danielle Smith.
Beauty is only 3,000 meters deep. The creatures who live near the ocean floor may not typically be known for being cute, but a new species of bumpy snailfish might just be the sweetest thing in salt water.
And observing the steed limit, remembering the Japanese racehorse Haru Urara, who became a national inspiration because of her remarkable consistency on the track, where she lost 113 consecutive races. As it happens, the Wednesday edition, radio that knows some heroes are larger than life and some are mere mortals. The war crimes case against Joseph Kony has made it to the International Criminal Court, even if the fugitive Ugandan rebel leader has not. The self-proclaimed prophet was the leader of the Lord's Resistance Army, a violent militia that sought to overthrow the Ugandan government and establish a state based on the Ten Commandments. It's estimated that since the 1980s, the LRA has killed more than 100,000 people, displaced 2 million people, and kidnapped tens of thousands of children who were forced to be wives to soldiers or become child soldiers themselves. This week, the ICC is hearing evidence that between July 2002 and December 2005, Joseph Kony committed 39 war crimes and crimes against humanity in northern Uganda. The court is set to decide whether it will confirm those charges. But even if it does, it's unclear what will happen next. The rebel leader has evaded arrest for years. Okot Moses has been following the hearings closely. He was born in LRA captivity. We reached him in Gulu, Uganda.
Okot, do these hearings represent in any way justice to you for what you and your mother endured?
To me, this hearing does not represent any justice to me and my mother and the rest of other children born of war and the mothers of the victims, the women victims in northern Uganda.
Why not?
First of all, I feel this hearing has no meaning because right now when I speak today in Gulu, you hear a lot of words from the victims themselves. You find that the victims have high expectation. You find that this kind of hearing has just increased more trauma. But most of the victims are asking themselves, why is it that Joseph Kony is not available even for the hearing or the confirmation of the hearings. Yeah. And this is a very alarming question, giving more trauma to the victims. And there's a lot of cries, personally to me and my mother.
This is the first time, we should let our audience know, that the ICC is holding hearings like this for a suspect in absentia. There are reports, people believe Kony might be hiding out in a remote part of the Central African Republic, the forest there, but he has not been caught, as you know. Decades have gone by. And I hear what you're saying. You and others believe if he's not there, then it can't feel like justice. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about how your mother came to be taken? Because you were born while your mother was being held as an LRA captive. How was she taken?
My mother told me that one day in the morning when she went to school, the bell that rang 10 a.m. in the morning was usually meant for them to go for breakfast in the morning. But this time around, it was the bell that caused fear in her. It was the bell that made her to be abducted and taken into captivity. They stayed in a camp called Nisitu. That is where she was given to my father, who was also abducted at 15 years old, and later on turned into a rebel. Mm-hmm. And then from there, it resulted into the birth of me as a child born of war.
How old was your mother when that bell rang and she was taken, abducted?
Well, my mother was abducted when she was 12 years old.
You were 3 years old when she managed to escape. You're 25 now, we should mention, but you were three you and your mother escaped. How
exactly
did she get away?
She told me that there was a battle, or there was an operation between the NRA government and the LRA government. Mm-hmm. And that night it was raining heavily. And it was a very hard battle. It was around Kitgum that she managed to escape with the rest of other people and reach a center in Pajule, where she managed to enter into a missionary center that took care of her and brought her back to the Gusko camp that kept her until she was given back to the family together with me.
You were 3 years old. I don't think you would have memories of that time, but did she tell you of what life was like as you were growing up in those early years, and she was there?
She literally refused to tell me what really happened. Mm-hmm. But one day when I was looking into her room, I got a very small book. Mm-hmm. And my memory book, it was a project that was initiated by the UBC in British Columbia, whereby the survivors of the network, the survivors of the conflict, would tell their story of how they went through the conflict.
At the University of British Columbia? Okay.
Yes. So when I entered into our room and I got that book, I started reading on how she was abducted, how she gave birth to me, and I got to know that from captivity I had a sister from there. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I had a sister who even died from there.
Oh.
And that is how I got to know a lot of the stories about in captivity now.
How old were you when you found that memory book and read it?
When I found the memory book, I was just 18 years old. 18 years old. Now, after I found the memory book, before I found the memory book, personally, I was battling with the issue of identity, right?
Yeah.
From the community that I stay, from the school that I went to, because every time I go to play as a child, with a child of a neighbor, I'll be abused, stigmatized, called names that I didn't know. But every time I tried asking my parents who I am, where my father comes from, or where I was born, this story is always hidden away from me until I found the book and I got the courage to ask her who I am, because I was really feeling very bad in society.
Because even though you had escaped this and gone through this trauma, living at home, people ostracized you. Why?
Yes, in the community where I come from, people assume that everyone who was in captivity participated directly into the killing of their family members or each and everyone. They will think that people who were abducted or the children who are born in captivity, they are born of spirit. They have evil spirit in them. They can. They literally call us name in the children that will say Olum and Konyi, which means these are the children of the Joseph Kony.
I'm sorry, Okot. I'm sorry that you went through that. What ultimately would justice look like for you?
Justice, to me, will be called justice when it's just and when it is not a performance-like. When I say a performance-like justice is when a case like this is being used as a test case for absentias. And justice for me, in the case of the context of my mothers who suffered the conflict, or of other children born of me, born of war, will be getting repaired for the atrocities that happened in my land or in my community. And this is something that I call justice.
I want to ask you about your mother. How is she doing now?
Well, my mother is doing well normally in the community, mm-hmm. and although there are different challenges, circumstances that always continuously comes in and go out in the society.
Okot, I very much appreciate your time. Thank you for this. Please take care.
Thank you too.
Okot Moses was born in LRA captivity and is now the chairperson of the Youth Advocacy Network. He's in Gulu, Uganda. Prime Minister Mark Carney is gearing up to head back to Parliament next week, and he seems to be itching to get things moving. He and his Liberal caucus are meeting in Edmonton today to iron out their priorities for the coming months, and one of those priorities is likely announcing which nation-building projects the new Major Projects Office, based in Calgary, will be taking on first. The Prime Minister is meeting with Alberta Premier Danielle Smith this evening, and she is expected to once again push for a new pipeline to make the cut. Here's some of what Premier Smith told reporters earlier today.
The Prime Minister's team is in place, my team is in place, and they're having very constructive conversations. And so we're very hopeful that in short order we'll be able to get this to the finish line together.
Kyle Bax is a business reporter with CBC Calgary. We reached him there earlier today.
Kyle, at the end of this evening, the end of this meeting between Prime Minister Carney and Premier Smith, what would that finish line look like? What is success for Premier Smith after this conversation?
I think it's trying to make some progress on some of the demands that she has made. She's asked for lots of different things. Mm-hmm. And I think what she's really going to want is to know that the federal government is serious about what it's been talking about, building major projects and growing the energy sector. Of course, it's Carney who's talked about turning Canada into an energy superpower. Mm-hmm.
And so it's already, even before this conversation, clearly a different relationship between this prime minister and this premier than the previous prime minister. But for Mark Carney at the end of this, what's a win for him?
I think it's sending the message to the provincial government here and to the province that he cares, that he's listening, and that he's willing to work together. You know, this government has said that it wants to be collaborative and work together with the provinces, and it probably has to achieve what it wants, in particular to kickstart the economy, build these big, significant infrastructure projects, and in general, turbocharge job creation. These are three big things, and you know, the government is going to need lots of allies to accomplish those goals.
And the Prime Minister did say today that he is planning to announce the first of those big projects, nation building, mm-hmm. as he's described them, tomorrow. Our colleagues at Radio Canada, as you also know, have learned that on that initial list, there is no oil pipeline. What kind of reaction, if any, has there been from Premier Smith to that?
Not too much reaction. She's, you know, basically talked about how she's waiting until the official announcement comes out. And she also referred to how the preliminary list that's kind of been floated around, it doesn't appear to be the final list. Mm-hmm. And on that point, she's right. You know, there has been this list that the Globe in particular has reported on. And it's being accepted as, you know, about how this could actually be the final list. And it's actually quite different. What it is that the federal government previously asked for recommendations from the provinces and from Indigenous leaders and some other groups. So basically a collection of ideas of what could make the list for what are these major projects, these nation building projects. And so that's what this list is. It's a list of suggestions that have been given to Ottawa. It's not necessarily the federal government's list that they've compiled, that they have said are going to be the priorities.
In your reporting, has shown that despite this support for a new pipeline from Premier Smith and Prime Minister Carney, no major company has shown an interest in applying to build one. Why?
Mm-hmm. Boy, to build a major export pipeline has been a pretty fraught exercise.
Yeah. Sure has.
There have been, over the last, let's say, 20 years, there have been a lot of failed projects, some of them that never got even close to construction. And let's, you know, even talk about the two that have been built in particular. There's the Trans Mountain expansion, that oil pipeline from Alberta to the BC's coast, and then also Coastal GasLink, which is, you know, in BC from the northeast part of the province to the coast. They faced court challenges, regulatory hurdles, countless protests. There were natural disasters like floods and wildfires. Yeah. There were years of delays, huge cost overruns. And so if you are a company looking to, you know, build a pipeline, are you really going to do it right now? Looking at how difficult it has been to build a pipeline in this country. But this is also where, you know, Danielle Smith, she kind of shares some responsibility. She had said this is her job. And so far that hasn't happened. And so, you know, if there's no oil pipeline that's announced on this list tomorrow, you know, she's probably going to have to share some responsibility for that.
She has said, and just recently, in fact, that, you know, federal policies, the greenhouse gas emissions cap have, quote, pummeled Alberta's economy. Are those policies really what is ultimately holding these proposals, these projects back?
It is part of the equation. You know, a company like Enbridge, they have said that there needs to be some changes to some of these policies before it would potentially pursue a new project. That's you know, federal policies are just one part of the whole equation. If you are a company looking to make this type of investment, you have to see, is there a potential route that makes sense? Are the communities along the route, are they on board? You have to go talk to a lot of the oil companies that produce the oil, and you have to have commitments from them about whether they're going to commit to use this pipeline potentially for 20 years. And so there's lots of different considerations before a company makes what is a pretty big decision.
I spoke with Natural Resources Minister Tim Hodgson on the program just a couple of weeks ago. And in that conversation, he said Canadians don't need to worry about the environmental impact of all of this, that they're going to weigh all of that as they look at these projects. How is that sitting with Albertans?
In general, in the province, I think, you know, the industry in particular has been really supportive of Carney since he's come into power. And even Tim Hodgson, mm-hmm. he came here in May, gave a speech in downtown Calgary, and he received a standing ovation. And there were several big name CEOs in that crowd, which, you know, is a rare thing to happen. It's also people just wondering about where Canada's headed. You know, you could tell over the last 10 years that the federal government's under Justin Trudeau, you know, was, you know, it put more of an emphasis, it seemed like, on the environment and on meeting climate goals and on the energy transition. And now there's concerns about, you know, is our economy really headed to transitioning to a cleaner economy, to transition to cleaner fuels? Or are we just trying to build a bigger economy without those environmental considerations?
I appreciate this, Kyle. Thank you.
Thank you, Neil.
Kyle Bax is a business reporter with CBC Calgary. That's where we reached him earlier today. from the radio program that brought you the ratfish, as it happens, proudly presents the bumpy snailfish. Now, earlier this week, we told you about the ratfish, which is a weird deep-sea creature with a bulbous appendage covered with teeth protruding from its forehead. It's a great example of the wondrous miracles of the deep, which are also, frankly, unattractive. But some of those miracles are cute as an underwater button, and the bumpy snailfish is one of them. It's one of three new species of snailfish analyzed in a new study in the journal Ichthyology and Herpetology. And after looking at a very high-definition video of this new species, our producers can confirm it is, in fact, Massadorbs. Mackenzie Gehringer is a deep-sea biologist and the study's lead author. We reached her in Geneseo, New York.
Mackenzie, I don't think the name bumpy snailfish really does it justice. Describe this little fish for us.
Well, I am very enamored with this fish. Yes. So this is a snailfish. It has a very round head and long tail, no scales. It is pink. It's about 9 centimeters long, and it does have bumpy skin, but I think in a very charming way, as well as large nostrils that it uses to smell its environment, and these great long finger-like fins that it's using to sense vibrations and chemicals in the water.
And pretty adorable eyes, too, but it really does look like it's smiling, and the eyes almost look blue, or maybe that's just a contrast with the pink skin.
They look blue to me as well. In the preserved specimen, they have a large clear lens. Mm-hmm. Fish eyes have a completely spherical lens, so they're very interesting looking. And they do look like they're smiling. They have... They actually have two sets of jaws. So in the front of the mouth, they have the set of jaws that we might expect. But snailfishes, like many other fishes, if you look at them in an X-ray, you can actually see that they have a second set of jaws in the back of the throat. So it has two smiles.
Why are they called snailfish? How did that name come about?
The bumpy snailfish might not have this characteristic very much, but snailfishes live, different species from the intertidal all the way down to deep sea trenches at depths more than 8,000 meters. And the shallow water ones are often green and brown in color. And they actually have a little disc on their stomachs that they can use to stick to rocks. And they curl up and look something like a snail. So that's where the group gets the English common name.
Maybe these cute pink ones need a separate nickname. But we can talk about that another day. We're here to talk about the bumpy snailfish.
We're open to suggestions.
Okay, well, our listeners will let us know. We'll make sure to share that with everyone when they write in, because we know they will. Part of the reason you mentioned the depths that we're talking about here, part of the reason this has made headlines, not just their cuteness, but the video is so clear and so beautiful. The music you've added to it, or someone has added to it, helps too. But how was that video captured?
So the Imbari team did a fantastic job with this video. It is not easy to get... even down to these depths, more than 3,000 meters, let alone to get such great video. So this was collected by what's called a remotely operated vehicle, or an ROV. Mm-hmm. It's an underwater robot. It's about the size of a small car. And the pilots and the videographers and the people controlling the lighting are driving it from up on the ship and exploring the depths, and they're able to make decisions underwater and sample and get some really great imagery like this one.
And your study doesn't just look at this cute, very cute fish. It looks at three new species of snailfish. What are the other two like?
I also think they're very charming as well. They are similar in size, so about 10 centimeters. They are all black, though. Okay. So one of them is a little bit of a textured black, and one is very, very sleek, kind of eel-like. So we've called these the dark snailfish and the sleek snailfish as the common names.
How do they manage to survive at these depths?
This is what I'm really excited about as a scientist, is that question. So it takes so much to adapt to these deep sea environments. We think of the deep sea as being so harsh due to these cold temperatures, high pressures, but to these fishes and others, it's just home. And so they are adapted from the molecules, the proteins, all the way up to the whole fish to survive under high pressure. Mm-hmm. They also have special adaptations to find food at these depths, to sense their environment in a very different way than we do, because there's no sunlight at these depths. So many different ways to evolve into these deep sea habitats.
Earlier this week, our listeners may remember, I spoke with a marine biologist, Carly Cohen, about the ratfish. Again, not loving the name. People may take issue with what it looks like, but she defended its appearance quite adamantly. She said its eyes, again with the eyes, made it look a bit spooky. Here's a bit more of her description.
They're these very shimmery, floating almost like fishes that have these massive eyes that kind of shine bright, almost bright green when light hits them in the deep sea. Kind of the same way that your cat's eyes might turn like green when you catch them. They've got these protein crystals in their eyes to help them see better in the dark.
What do you think, Mackenzie? Have you seen a ratfish, or do you find them as beautiful?
I do, and I think Dr. Cohen does a great job highlighting the deep sea is very peaceful. So when you do have the opportunity to see video in this habitat, or if you have the privilege to dive in a submersible, for me, it's the feeling like being in a national park. It really is this very peaceful, beautiful habitat. And I think that these organisms are very graceful, very ethereal, and they have a lot to teach us about life on our planet.
And the camera loves them. Which doesn't hurt, I guess.
Oh, absolutely.
Mackenzie.
Very charming.
They are. Mackenzie, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Mackenzie Gehringer is a deep sea biologist and an associate professor of biology at the State University of New York at Geneseo. We reached her in Geneseo, New York. Now, if you have a nickname suggestion for the bumpy snailfish, first look at a picture. That's just for fun and enjoyment. And then call TalkBack at 416-205-5687 or email us your nickname suggestion, aih@cbc.ca. The year 1998, the place, Japan's Kochi Racecourse, seemed like just an ordinary day at the track, but one horse was about to surprise everyone. When I say that Haru Urara surprised everyone at her first ever race, I should have specified that by everyone, I meant everyone who thought she might win or do well, because she didn't either. She lost. But her trainer did not give up on her. And in her second race, she also lost. But for Haru Urara, whose name translates to glorious spring, the third time would be the charm. Except no, it wouldn't. Look, let me skip ahead here. Haru Urara lost 113 races. She only even placed second in four. She was very bad at horse racing. But in this awkward steed, Japanese fans saw a creature who would never give up. Now, partly because there was a smallish person on her back yelling, "Come on!" of course, but mostly in an era of high unemployment and economic decline, because of what they perceived to be her indomitable spirit, her refusal to give less than her all, a spirit that earned her the nickname the shining star of losers everywhere. Haru Urara died yesterday at the farm where she had spent her retirement. She was 29, which a farm spokesperson points out is the equivalent of 90 in human years. During her streak, people flocked to the racetrack where she lost, saving that track from bankruptcy. She became internationally famous, and countless people contacted her trainer to say that she had saved them from despair, because she may have been hapless, but she was never hopeless. Here are the Majestics with The Horse. Thank you. Majestics with The Horse.
We're going to take a short break now. When we return, a setback in the fight for same-sex relationship rights in Hong Kong, but one advocate tells us he is confident this is not the end of the story.
Paul Schaefer reflects on the 1972 production of Godspell that launched the careers of Canada's comedy elite and the fluke that landed him the job as the production's musical director.
And protesters in Rochester send ICE agents packing. Stay tuned. I'm Neil Kirksall.
And I'm Chris Howden.
Thank you for listening to As It Happens here on People Powered KAXE. Good evening, I'm Jennifer Barr. At 7 o'clock, Sarah is your volunteer host for On the River. It's a great mix of music. More great music continues on Headwaters at 10 o'clock with Malachi Coons. Support for this program comes from Sanford Health. With primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest, Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. We also thank Atchison Tire in Grand Rapids, providing service and offering tire brands like Bridgestone, Firestone, and Toyo, serving the area since 1916. More at atchisontire.com. Patchy fog overnight with lows 49 to 52, and then widespread fog early tomorrow morning, becoming mostly sunny, high 71 to 74. Chance of rain in the evening with overnight lows near 60. Slight chance of rain Friday morning, highs in the upper 70s.
Amnesty International says lawmakers in Hong Kong are showing alarming disdain for 2S LGBTQ+ rights. Earlier today, those lawmakers overwhelmingly struck down a bill that would have granted same-sex couples who got married or formed civil unions abroad some rights relating to medical and funeral decisions. Jerome Yao is the co-founder of the nonprofit Hong Kong Marriage Equality. We reached him in Hong Kong.
Jerome, this is obviously not the result you and many others, the people you work with, were hoping for, but ultimately the numbers, the overwhelming result, you know, 71 of 89 lawmakers voting against this, rejecting this. How did those numbers sit with you? Did they catch you off guard?
Not exactly. Before the vote, there were multiple reports indicating that the bill would be heading into defeat. Lots of us were sort of prepared for the outcome, as much as that's not the kind of outcome we would love to see.
Why do you think this was rejected?
I think it speaks to a very strong and vocal group of lawmakers who are basically very conservative when it comes to some social or moral issues. I mean, obviously, during the debate, they made arguments against the idea of recognizing same-sex relationships, either because they feared that would lead to eventually same-sex marriage, which they were against, or sometimes they feared that that would have a negative effect on the next generation, or sometimes they fear what will happen to adoption rights, for example, when there's a legal system recognizing same-sex relationships. So there were all these kind of fears, which, quite frankly, not unheard of, must be very familiar with lots of people, you know, looking back over the so many years when different places around the world. So going through this process and these kind of arguments keep coming up. So from that perspective, no surprise.
And to be clear for our listeners, this was not about legalizing same-sex marriage in Hong Kong at this stage. These were really incremental changes. But if even those kinds of incremental changes cannot pass, what message does that send?
That obviously doesn't sound a very good message to both society and the international community. I mean, basically, what we were saying is it raises questions as to the city itself, whether it's open, it's welcoming, whether it is embracing diversity and inclusivity. It definitely doesn't send a very good signal. But I would say, I mean, as much as obviously the outcome is not ideal, but if we believe in scientific survey, then the message is quite clear. Back in 2023, there was a survey done by three universities, two local, one in the States, suggesting 60% of the population supported same-sex marriage. That was a very strong majority. Mm-hmm. So no question to doubt, you know, as to where the level of support is in the in society. It just so happened that when it comes to the legislature, it's dominated by conservative voices. You know, on one hand, there's a strong sort of obstacle when it comes to the political process. But when it comes to public opinion, we have reasons to believe public opinion is on our side.
So it sounds like, obviously, you're disappointed, but not deterred. It sounds like you think it's a matter of time. It's just a matter of time.
It is a matter of time. It is absolutely a matter of time.
You mentioned the research in 2023. That was a significant year for another reason, because there was a higher court ruling in your favor at that time. This bill came after that. Just remind our listeners briefly what the court ruled at that time.
Correct. So our top court, the Court of Final Appeal, handed down a ruling in September 2023. The court was dealing with three questions. The first question was whether there was a constitutional right to same-sex marriage, or whether overseas same-sex marriages should be recognized in Hong Kong, and what if the answers to those questions are in the negative, is there an obligation to have some sort of legal recognition for same-sex relationships? So to make a long story short, the court ruled that, first of all, there isn't a constitutional right to same-sex marriage in Hong Kong. And then the court also ruled that overseas same-sex marriages, the government has no obligation to recognize those marriages. But on the other hand, the court, by a 3-2 majority, ruled that the government has a positive duty to recognize same-sex relationships via an alternative framework. That's why eventually that the government tabled a bill, mm-hmm. but unfortunately the bill got defeated today.
Yeah. And it was same-sex partnerships formed overseas is what the focus was in
Correct.
This bill. But does this rejection put it in breach potentially of that 2023 judgment?
I would say so. Obviously, we are currently in a state of non-compliance. But I think we just need to wait for the government to tell us what they plan to do, because the court, when they delivered the ruling back in 2023, the court gave the government 2 years to come up with this framework. The deadline is October the 27th, mm-hmm. 2025, so a little bit more than a month away. So I think now the government needs to, you know, tell us, hopefully before the deadline, as to what they plan to do in light of the fact that the bill got defeated. It would be in the best interest of the whole society for the government to actively engage stakeholders in order to find a way out. So I would say the defeat, yes, is a setback, but it's not the end of the story.
Is that what you're saying to the folks you represent who might be
yes.
even more disappointed? How do you get them through this and tell them to stay patient?
Yeah, we've been saying that this is a long game. Even let's say, if the bill for some reason were passed today, it doesn't mean that our work will come to an end. Obviously, that proposed framework is far from what we are asking. You know, it's definitely not same-sex marriage. It's not even civil partnership or civil union. It's a very, very simple registration system. A lot of work still needs to be done in order to hopefully one day we would see that same-sex couples in Hong Kong enjoy full legal protection and equal recognition.
Jerome, I'm very glad we could speak. Thank you for this.
Thank you.
Jerome Yao is the co-founder of the nonprofit Hong Kong Marriage Equality. He's in Hong Kong. Long before they made their way to SCTV and Saturday Night Live, they were on stage at the Royal Alexandra Theatre in Toronto in the 1972 production of Godspell. That show is a musical retelling of the Book of Matthew, and that production featured a cast of then unknowns, including Martin Short, Gilda Radner, Eugene Levy, and Andrea Martin, to name a few. The production was obviously an incubator for up-and-coming Canadian comedians who would later become worldwide stars. Among those who owe their success to Godspell is musical director and pianist Paul Schaefer, who spent years backing David Letterman on late night TV. He recently spoke to CBC Toronto in advance of a new documentary about that 1972 show.
We were all about 22 years old. It was everyone's first job, except for with a few exceptions like Jane Eastwood, still delightful as ever. Well, one of the great things about this documentary is that they reassembled the company. It's towards the end of the thing, and we have a big jam session, and we all sing through the score of Godspell, even today, and in our old decrepit selves that we are today. And man, it was a lot of fun to see everybody again. Marty and Eugene and I are particularly still close friends. Mm-hmm. Whenever we get together, we immediately sing through all the music of Godspell.
I can tell.
Almost automatically.
And you do a mean job on the piano.
thanks. Sure, I could still do it. I don't know if the other kids could, the cast members could still do it. Very hard on the knees, this Godspell show. Yeah. You had to be 22, you know.
You got into all of that. I mean, you were there at the auditions. There were only 10 spots that were available, but you jumped into it. It was almost a bit of a fluke.
It really was some sort of Hollywood discovery. For me, I went to accompany people on two different gals that I knew were auditioning for this show. Mm-hmm. The composer was Stephen Schwartz, who today is maybe the most successful Broadway composer in history with Wicked. Mm-hmm. And this was his first show, Godspell, and he came to Toronto to cast. And when he heard me accompanying my friends, Stephen Schwartz said, "I want to talk to that piano player." Mm-hmm. He said, "Can you play for the rest of the auditions? Play for the different people, because you seem to know all the songs, you know." And that's the one thing I did. I know a lot of songs. And at the end of the day, he said to me, "Can you put a band together and conduct this show?" And just like that, I was in the business. I really just out of school, for I graduated from U of T. It's a good thing too, because I had just taken a year off. You know, I'd promised my parents that if I was starving in a year, I'd go back to school in some way. This saved me from having to do that.
Canadian musician Paul Schaefer talking about his time as the musical director of Godspell. That 1972 production is the focus of a new documentary screening at the Toronto International Film Festival called You Had to Be There, How the Toronto Godspell Ignited the Comedy Revolution, Spread Love and Overalls, and Created a Community that Changed the World in a Canadian Kind of Way. Lately, nearly every day, there's a story about an immigration raid in the U.S., and that was almost the headline yesterday in Rochester, New York. But instead, it ended like this. The sound of protesters in Rochester as ICE agents left a home where they'd been attempting to detain a group of roofers. Lauren Urzetta was at the protest. She's a minister at the local Spiritus Christi Church. We reached her in Rochester.
Lauren, you got a phone call yesterday morning. What did the person on the other end say?
So they said, "Drop what you're doing. We need help. Mm-hmm. It's an urgent situation." And we have had conversations with this person before about what we would do in this mm-hmm. situation. So we went right into action.
And so it sounds like there had been planning and preparation, but you'd never received that kind of call before.
Yes, exactly. So we have been working with this group mm-hmm. actually since before the inauguration about how we would could be called upon, or if ICE came to our church, what we would do. So we knew sort of the drill mm-hmm. When we would get a phone call.
What did you do?
We alerted one of our Spanish-speaking employees, and then we just got right in the car and while our AV director drove, we just sort of put like the call out to anyone and everyone that we knew would be willing to essentially form like a human chain.
And what kind of time frame are we talking about from getting that call, the one that actually says after all this time, we need you to jump into action, to actually you're getting to this house?
Oh, so we were probably in the house in about 7 minutes. Mm. When we got there, there was probably like 20 people. And then very quickly, it grew from about 20 to like 100 to 100 and plus.
That's the supportive presence that you were hoping for. What else was happening when you got there? There were ICE agents already there?
We could see about like 4 or 5 ICE agents. They were sort of hiding in the back of these two houses, one next to where the roofers were. They tried to tell us not to come on the property, but since we had been so well trained in the Know Your Rights, you know, we knew that they couldn't tell us that. Mm-hmm. We were told right upon arrival, the homeowner said we could be on the property to try and protect the men. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we just sort of planted ourselves right in front of the fire escape.
And where were the roofers?
On the roof.
Yeah. And what were they doing?
Literally, like, cowering in fear.
And the agents themselves, the ICE agents, I mean, we've seen in videos in previous raids or you know, when they detain people right off the street, they're often wearing masks. What did they look like there?
So I would say some of the younger men seemed to be, were wearing masks. Mm-hmm. And the older ones were a little bit more boisterous. The older looking ICE agents, you know, were more willing to sort of like get into our faces. But once they sort of felt like the presence of the crowd growing and growing that quickly, which I was surprised, they were like sort of retreating almost. Mm-hmm. You could like feel the shift in sort of the like balance.
The power dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, with all the you know, all the iPhones out, all the cameras, people, you know, we got the okay to go live, and just like the power of like a growing crowd.
Mm-hmm. Who was in that crowd? The people who answered that email, answered your call. Describe for our listeners, mm-hmm. because it was quite a large gathering as it built. It was building up. Who made up the crowd?
So what I thought was really beautiful was this like intergenerational coming together of communities. So it's like people who probably protested Vietnam War to people who are in their 20s. I just like got chills saying that because, you know, a lot of our parishioners, our church members showed up instantly. A lot of them who were retired, who could just, they weren't working, so they could just quickly get there. And then just like a lot of young people. And then I would say 7 faith leaders from different churches in the area just were instantly there. And then some of our elected officials started to show up as well.
There are always risks, though. Things could have gone differently. They could have gone mm-hmm. terribly wrong. There's chaos and tension, certainly raids like this, so much at stake, and many, many people involved. Our listeners may remember a farm worker fell off of a roof and later died back in July. It was a different circumstance. It wasn't a crowd like this, but that farm worker was trying to avoid the ICE agents there. So what kinds of conversations or concerns do you and your colleagues have that these kind of protest interventions might exacerbate things or raise tensions and potentially become dangerous?
Yeah, so just knowing, you know, the correct way, I guess, to show up and, you know, at the end of the day, like, listening does have to happen and trying to, avoid, like, unnecessary arousal of, like, the other of the ICE agents. And, you know, we really were trying to take the lead of the negotiator and showing that we were mm-hmm. A woman, the legal representative who was speaking with the ICE agents. You know, at the end of the day, you know it's a risk. And that's why we started off right after the inauguration or right before the inauguration doing the trainings and being very blunt. You know, the groups we were working with were very clear, very blunt that you are taking a risk by doing this type of work.
When we're talking about the people most impacted by this, we know the local Rochester NPR station says one of the roofers was detained by ICE before the crowd gathered, before your protest started. The that outlet quotes the worker's boss as saying his name is Chino and that he's been in the U.S. for 25 years, had legal documentation to work, and a baby on the way. Do you have any information what has happened to Chino?
No, like I spoke of before, I'm assuming he's already been brought to a detention center, and that's what, you know, unfortunately, the laws that have been voted in, this isn't allowed. You know, this sort of like take now, ask later, it should not be happening. And this is a result of it.
And do you, is there any question, is there any doubt in your mind that if that protest had not happened, if you and the others weren't there, about what would have happened to the other men on that roof?
Oh, they would have been taken. I mean, that's what I think is a little scary. It's like, you know, how do we show up to all of these? You know, that's what's terrifying.
Lauren, I appreciate this. Thank you.
Yep.
Please take care, Lauren.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Lauren Urzeta is a minister at the local Spiritus Christi Church in Rochester, New York. The city of Winnipeg is considering stricter rules around homeless encampments. If they're passed, the new measures would prohibit the camps near schools, parks, or other recreational facilities. The CBC's Jim Agapito talked to some people staying in encampments in Winnipeg about what those restrictions could mean for them.
This is all new to me. Yeah. I really don't know where I'm going to go after this. Maybe Salons, maybe somewhere I can actually get under a roof. I don't want to leave because it's a safe place.
Safer than, say, somewhere like Salom or a shelter?
Yeah, I don't like crowded places. I like to be away from that.
If an outreach worker came and as part of the homeless strategy that the city has and offered, you know, housing, is it something you would accept and why?
Housing? Yeah, I would go to housing. But no worker came down at all. I want to be under a roof. It's going to get cold, man. And it's going to be hard for the winter time. You know, I would love to be inside.
Is that something that you work towards? Have you tried to make that motion?
Yeah. I've tried, they failed me.
Do you worry, like, if the city tightens down on encampments, like, people are going to have harder times finding places to stay?
It's a tough question. I would think that maybe people don't take enough initiative to start looking for housing in the first place. But then again, the system itself is, you know, it's out of whack. So people get discouraged by the amount of rent given. And then the rents from the caretakers is skyjacked every year. So it's hard to, you know, stay ahead. Especially if you're on a fixed budget. It's, you know, it's crazy. Some people pay their bills rather than eat.
For people who are, like, really up in arms against encampments and shelters and stuff, what would your message to them be?
Give it time. Time. Maybe they can come to a solution where they have an area that's designated for it, you know, a piece of land somewhere that's, you know, off the beaten path of the grid, and, you know, where they can just be themselves and be, you know, humans. Live. Yeah, I mean, that would be the overall goal. I mean, some people just don't want to be in shelters. There's too much drama, and the theft is just unbelievable. It's crazy.
The CBC's Jim Agapito talking to residents of homeless encampments in Winnipeg.
You've been listening to As It Happens from CBC, heard across the United States on public radio.
You can also find As It Happens wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Chris Howden. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Neil Kirksall. Goodbye.
This is 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are People Powered Radio in Northern Minnesota. I am Sarah Sarah, your host for the evening, and this is On the River. It looks as though tonight, mostly sunny, highs near 74, calm wind, patchy fog lay otherwise mostly clear, lows 49 to 52. Thursday could be widespread fog early, then mostly sunny, highs 71 to 74 with a chance of rain in the evening.